welcome back to another episode of the Fundamentally Sound Podcast, Final Four Edition. As always, I'm your host, Reeks from Barstool Sports, and I have a four-guest episode today. What I did is record here on Sunday, March 25th, after the games ended, for the most part, to get one kind of member associated with each of the Final Four teams, whether it's a former player or media member. So I am joined by Ryan Archidiacono, former player at Villanova, current player with the Chicago Bulls, Zach Novak, former player at Michigan, Chris Stone, who covers college basketball and NBA draft everywhere, who is a graduate from Kansas and knows that program super well, and then Scott Phillips from NBC Sports and NBC Sports Chicago to talk Loyola, as he's from that area and knows that team well. So we have a huge episode. Obviously, great ending to that Duke-Kansas game. That to me, that was the best game of the tournament so far, even though it wasn't exactly the best played. But that's kind of been how the tournament's been, right? Like, there's been a lot of entertaining games because it's been close at the end, not necessarily super well played, not very highly executed like we've seen in years past. But to my memory, this is one of the more entertaining tournaments that's been out there. A lot of close games, a lot of games coming down to the stretch. You know, I've been very vocal about how I think the officiating's been poor, and unfortunately one of the storylines throughout the tournament has been the officiating. Hopefully that changes in the Final Four because refs advance based on grading. So in theory, we're getting the best of the best for the Final Four and the National Championship. That makes me feel pretty good inside to get that. Before we get into it, though, go check out 199.com. That's 19NINE.com. They have all your replica retro college basketball shorts, t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts. They're incredibly comfortable, incredibly fire, and you get 10% off if you use Fundamentals at checkout. This deal lasts just through this week because, well, March is over, unfortunately. So go to 19NINE.com, use Fundamentals at checkout, and you get 10% off. As always, I do have to request, please, please, with just a short amount of time left in March, go to Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, whatever, and rate, review, subscribe. We've cracked the top 100 a couple times, which helps me a lot on the back end, get guests, line up shows, do everything like that. So please, please help out there. Like I said, you just go to Google Play, Apple Podcasts, whatever, search Fundamentally Sound, click the link in my Twitter bio. And subscribe, rate, review. Helps a long way. Like I said, long show, big show. We have four guests. We'll get into it here right away with Ryan Archidiacono, the Chicago Bulls and former Villanova player. All right, and now I welcome back onto the show again my guy, former Villanova Wildcat, current Chicago Bull, Ryan Archidiacono. Ryan, what's going on, man?
Not much in Chicago. It's a great day. The Wildcats win, and then the local Loyola Ramblers winning. So it's very happy times out here in Chicago in the college world.
Yeah, it's a pretty good weekend for you, all things considered. But really, what about these last 5 years for Nova? I think this win all but solidifies that Villanova's probably been the best program, what, the last 5 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a testament to Coach Wright and the coaching staff of bringing in very good basketball players who buy into the system of Villanova basketball. They all have high IQs. They're all good kids, and they're willing and willing to learn from a great coach and willing to learn from each other and get better and play together as one unit out on the floor.
All right, so obviously I want to ask you about the Final Four with your time winning a title there. We were talking about it just before we started recording that I completely forgot that you guys had Eric Pascal and Dante DiVincenzo redshirting the year you won it. And you mentioned that your guys' scout team included those two, Mikhail Bridges, Phil Booth, and then a fifth of, you know, someone coming off the bench. That has to be the most ridiculous scout team ever, right?
Yeah. Three
pros.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a really good squad. Unfortunately, Dante got hurt early in the year. Eric had to sit out from transferring from Fordham. And then you had Mikhail, Phil, and one of our walk-ons who was a really good athlete, whether it was Pat Farrell, Kevin Rafferty, or Henry Lowe, who's on the staff now. It was great because Dante really prepared us for when he was Buddy Hield. So when we played Oklahoma, he was basically Buddy Hield. Eric was was either Spangler or Latin, and then they had another guard on the team. I'm Cousins too. So we had a solid little group of our second team that would kind of give us the work in practice, and they scored on us more than Oklahoma did in that Final Four game. But it was tough, and having three players like that and on the current team who were able to push us and help us to get to the national or win the national championship just proves how good Villanova basketball has been these last couple of years.
Now, I'm not a huge fan of the theory that you have to have experience to win, because we've seen it happen both ways. But when it gets to this stage of the tournament where you're now in the Final Four, how important is it that this team has those five guys? Brunson seeing significant minutes, Bridges and Booth seeing significant minutes back when you guys won the title. How important is it to have five guys with experience of knowing what it's like to go through it? Because it is a whole different animal when you get to the Final Four versus the first couple rounds.
Definitely. I think we've seen teams with one and done be able to go down and win the national championship. But I think in the last couple of years, there's always kind of been a few seniors and guys who've had some type of experience in the NCAA tournament. Once you get to that Final Four, it's more than just basketball games. It's like a whole production of a week. You got to do the open practices. You have to do the live video shoots. You have to do just a whole bunch of crap, and you kind of forget about the basketball game. So I think having our guys go down there this year again, it's going to be a little bit of an edge that they've been there before. They know what it takes to kind of deal with all the distractions, but be able to focus and know why that you're actually in San Antonio and you're there to play a basketball game. You're not there to just kind of put on a show for everyone. So I think it'll really help them and really benefit them in the long run, having been there a few years ago.
Yeah. So what's the typical travel schedule for a team going to the Final Four? You guys typically head down on what, like Tuesday?
Yeah, they'll probably head down on Tuesday because the games are Saturday. So probably get down there Tuesday night, Wednesday. You'll probably do some media, some like live videos. I think your open practice might be Thursday, 2 days before. So you'll go do your open practice, which is kind of crazy having 35,000 people just there to watch you do some shooting drills and kind of go through your plays and all that. And then you'll have like another legit practice at a local university, I'm sure. That's what we did when we were in Houston. And then Friday, you just practice at the arena. You'll be able to get the arena time. And then Saturday, it's just the game. But there's just so much crap because you have to worry about your parents, your family, your siblings getting tickets for this person, ask for that person. So many people come out of the woodworks trying to ask for tickets. But you just have to know that you just have to tell them, hey, I'm here to play basketball. You can talk to my parents. That's what I said. So there are a lot of distractions, but it's a good reason or a good time to have a few distractions here and there, but just to focus on the game is the most important thing.
What day is the weirdest as a player? Because like you said, you're going through things that are just not standard or not typical. It's just not basketball, like you said. What day, if there is a day, that is the weirdest when you're down at the Final Four?
It might be your open practice because you're there at the arena. Either you come from a practice or you're going to practice after your little live hour session at the arena because you have to do, like I said, the videos, your introductions, your name, there may be like a funny video. You go through all the media. You have your own individual meeting sessions. There's just cameras and media everywhere. And then you go out on the floor. You can kind of barely hear each other. You're kind of getting used to shooting in an NFL stadium or a big arena. So it's probably that day where you have the open practice because that's when you're like, oh my God, we're so cool. We're in the Final Four. This is what you always dream about. But you really just have to kind of focus on that floor and focus on the 94 by 50 feet is what we always said at Villanova. Just focus on the court and focus on each other and let everything else take care of itself.
Now, when you guys made your run, it was obviously predicated on shooting. I saw a stat I was going through heading into the Sweet 16. I think you guys were shooting 42% over the 10 game stretch leading into it. This year's team is shooting 41%. Now, obviously today in the Elite Eight, they shoot 16% from three. Is it almost weird to see, and not for lack of a better word, but to see this team go back to the defense and for Villanova, I don't want to say the haters that are out there, but that are live by the three, die by the three. Is this team almost suited better to avoid games like this where they shoot 16% and still get a win?
Yeah, I mean, we did it in our run. We shot the lights out our first two game or first three games, and then we play Kansas in the Elite Eight, and we go 4-for-18 and kind of grind out the same type of game and win it like 62-57, 58 around there. So I always say, going through the tournament, there's always going to be one game where you're not going to shoot well, and you're going to have to grind it out on the defensive end. And I think that was that game today. I could just sense it early. We weren't making shots, but we were really grinding on the defensive end. And I tweeted out a little prematurely that I thought this game was already over with like 2 minutes left in the first half, because I could just see it just being one of those beautiful, ugly Villanova basketball games where we're not making shots, but we're grinding out stops and able to pull through in the end. And that's what we did. So I think it kind of shuts down the people who say you live by the three, die by the three, because when you defend at a high level like Villanova does, this team, you can not shoot well and win the game by 12 when you make four threes. But if you make 11 threes, you're winning the game by 30. You know what I mean? I think that's just the capability of this Villanova team, is that they can lock you down on the defensive end. And when they're making shots, I'm not sure there's any team that can really beat them. But I know whoever's playing now, Loyola, Michigan, or Duke or Kansas, is going to be a tough battle, whoever has to play Villanova, whether they make shots or miss them.
Is it frustrating as a shooter when you guys are on such a hot streak? And then you have the game, like, you, weirdly enough, it was the Elite Eight for your guys' team and this year's team. Is it frustrating when you're in the game to get these open looks and, you know, they're short, or, you got a couple rim outs? How do you adapt to now, okay, don't shoot, keep attacking, when the offense is predicated on that pace and space and use the small ball type lineup? Is it difficult in that one game elimination setting to kind of alter your mindset of, okay, attack, 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 don't settle for a three?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely frustrating, because I know for our three-game stretch in my year, we were knocking down shots left and right. But like I said, once you go further along in the tournament, you're going to play better defensive teams that kind of maybe you think you're open and you're a half second, they're a half second earlier than you thought they would have been. It's just as you go along in that tournament, defense really turns up. I mean, you can't just keep consistently shooting threes, but that's what Villanova does. We shot 18 my year. They shot 24, 25 today. But like I said, the ability to grind out stops on the defensive end and create offense from the turnovers and getting out and getting them in foul trouble in the first half and being able to shoot more free throws than the other team attempts is what Villanova prides themselves on.
Do you see any similarities besides five players between your guys' title team and this year's team? And whether it's the chemistry. I saw after the game Jalen talking about how he mentioned all 3 years he's been at Nova, there's just this closeness within the roster. Do you see similarities between your team and this year's team?
Oh, definitely. I think that one thing's always going to be consistent with Villanova is that they're going to have great chemistry. I think Coach Wright, like I said before, he brings in high-character guys who buy into the system, and that system is getting along with your teammates and having great chemistry. And I think I saw Dante, after he got fouled, made a free throw here and there with 40 seconds left, he ran out, he got subbed out of the game, and he sat down for half a second and then was standing up cheering. I think it's just the positive reinforcement and the positive attitude that they have and Coach Wright instills in all the players that just buy in. I think it's just like we had in 16, and I think it's like every team that plays at Villanova. Because they genuinely like each other both on and off the floor, and I think that chemistry takes them a long way.
I want to go back to the defense real quick. And today I noticed in the first half they ran three different defenses, the standard switching man that you guys run. They ran a 2-3, yeah, and then kind of like this amoeba matchup man zone they ran for two possessions. You guys, during your title run, kind of mixed and matched defenses based on matchups. It's similar with like the shooting thing I asked, is it difficult, or what's the mindset of, okay, not man, going to 2-3? Is it tougher to switch defenses, or is it tougher to adjust offensively?
I think it would be tougher to adjust offensively. I mean, Coach Wright's a really, really good coach, and I don't want to give away exactly what he does, but knowing, watching these games, I'm like, all right, I know what he's going to do coming out of this timeout. Because most of the time, teams, if they're not playing well, they're trying to draw up and get an easy bucket to get the confidence going against the man. And what do you do coming out of a timeout? Just throw a different defense at them. So it takes away half their shot clock. They're kind of disorganized and they're not running the plays that the coaches drew up. So I think it's easy to adjust on the defensive end.
All right,
not making shots. You're going to have to get to the paint and everything.
All right, I'll let you get out of here with this. Villanova wins the championship if what happens? What's the thing you're keeping an eye on these next two games?
If they continue to play like they're doing now, I mean, if they play the defense they have been these last couple games, I don't think it really matters what happens on the offensive end. Clearly, they have to score points, but I think that if they keep defending at a high level, they'll score enough points to win.
All right, man, I appreciate it. Stay healthy the rest of the season, and good luck up there in Chicago.
Sounds good. Thank you.
We'll see you. All right, and now for the Kansas section, I welcome on my guy Chris Stone from quite literally everywhere on the internet. You can read his work at Sporting News, FanSided, and like I said, pretty much anywhere there's a website he's on. Chris, what's going on, man?
Not too much. Just hanging out in the Washington airport on my way to the McDonald's game. Excited to talk a little bit about Kansas.
Yeah, pretty good day for you, huh?
Pretty strong day for the Jayhawks. I think an unexpected one given the matchup. I thought that Marvin Bagley would probably dominate them to the tune of about 28 and 15.
Helps if he touches the ball.
He did not. Yeah, that was a really weird move.
Well, it helps if Duke has a good point guard.
There's that. I thought, you know, Trevon Duval was good taking the ball to the basket tonight, but not a great half-court facilitator.
He was fine in the first half. The second half, he was atrocious. Like, the first half, he was fine. Second half, he settled. Like, I remember there was the one possession where he, like, 25, 20 seconds left on the shot clock. Nobody touched the ball besides him, and he took two dribbles to the left, kind of off the screen, and jacked a three that had no chance of going in. And it's just like, you should immediately be benched in that. I was shocked that Kay was willing to adjust the defense and go to that 1-3-1, which got lit up for a couple possessions, but refused to adjust bringing in, like, Alex O'Connell and going kind of smaller to where there's at least another shooter on the floor and letting Bagley try to initiate there because Azubuki in foul trouble. And then, I mean, I'll take my chances with Bagley versus D'Souza.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, I thought Kay was kind of behind, one step behind Kansas all night in the coaching matchup. I thought Self came in with the perfect game plan for their kind of 2-3, you know, we jokingly call it a 4-1 because they elevate the wings so high. Self came in with the perfect game plan against that, which wasn't go to the middle and the free throw line. It was go to the baseline and put Wendell Carter in these weird 2-on-1 situations where he had to defend two guys at once, and it was just awkward. And, you know, then he switches into that 1-3-1 out of the halftime to kind of try to take that away. And Kansas just immediately goes to its offense of running the baseline and generating corner threes. And it just seemed like Self was one step ahead. And in terms of Duval, Kansas was just willing to you know, let him shoot and play. If he was the guy who was going to beat him, I think that they were okay with that. And they showed that in the first couple possessions when they just doubled off of his guy as soon as Marvin Bagley touched the ball in the post.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty evident that their strategy was, okay, Trayvon, you beat us. Because they weren't even guarding him. Like, they had there was a couple possessions where Azubuki was the man, quote, guarding Duval, and he was standing in the post.
Yeah, I mean, there was it was pretty clear early on, I think, that was going to be their game plan. Like, the second possession of the game, Bagley caught the ball on right block where he usually doesn't catch it, right? And Devontae Graham doubled from Trayvon Duval all the way from across the court and, like, sprinted over to double Bagley. And it was just clear that whoever was guarding Trayvon Duval was going to be Kansas's double man all night. And if Duval made some shots, then that's, you know, what was going to happen. But they weren't going to let Duke's best players beat them.
And if you're Duke, you almost had to be thrilled that he was, like, what, 2 for 6 from three?
I mean,
you're not thrilled that he shot 6 times, but he hit 2 of them. Like, I feel like most Duke fans and the Duke coaching staff was probably like, all right, that's a win. That's 6 free points.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, their frustrations, obviously, I think, have to be with the rough game that Grayson had shooting the ball and just not really able to get anything going in his last game of his college career. Yeah, that's true, too. Trent 2 for 10, Grayson 2 for 9 from deep. Like, those are just kind of unacceptable numbers from your two best 3-point shooters in a game where you're playing a team that is going to take enough threes that they're going to make a lot of them. And I think that put Duke in some really tough spots.
Yeah, that's where I'm surprised that Duke didn't go small, just to give a different look, right? Just to say, okay, we can go 4 out because you could at least go, you know, if you're going Bagley, Allen, Trent, O'Connell, and I guess you have to go, what, Duval there?
Yeah, I think so.
Like,
I mean, I don't know that I think that that's a great way to win the game, because they kind of got shredded when they took Wendell Carter out of the game.
Yeah, but if you do it for like five possessions.
Yeah, I mean, they should have tried something. And it was clear that they were willing to try some different things, right? They ran that three big lineup with Delorier,
that was weird.
Bagley, and Carter out for a possession or two. And Kansas immediately went into a triangle and two, which I thought was another great self-coaching move. And, so Kay was clearly willing to try some lineup combinations, but then he just didn't, you know, go anywhere else after that three big lineup didn't work for him.
I talked about that in my preview about how, you know, I was thinking about how they ran the triangle two against Kentucky the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And just going, we're going to see some sort of junk defense. I was surprised they didn't run it more. I mean, it worked out the way they defended, but I thought they'd run the triangle two for like 20% of possessions.
Yeah. It probably would have worked on possessions where they had Duval, Bagley, and Carter on the floor. But it works so perfectly when you have the three bigs on the floor because, you know, those three guys don't necessarily need individual matchups on the perimeter. They're not huge threats to create from there. And then you just stick your two guards on the two guys who can dribble and put them in a really tough spot. So I thought that Kansas might roll it out a little bit more, but I guess it doesn't surprise me since, you know, I thought Svi did a really good job defending Bagley down low, which was a total surprise.
Is this the best coaching job of Self's career this year?
Probably at this point. I mean, everybody likes to say that they don't have the talent of past Kansas team, which is certainly true, but they do have a ton of really good college basketball players. So I'm not sure that that's entirely fair to them. But, you know, the quality of the Big 12 this year was really high. I think that they probably don't win the league if Keenan Evans doesn't break his toe, which, by the way, is totally insane that Keenan Evans played on a broken toe.
He's a dude. Like, that's
– yeah.
And played totally as well insane. As he did.
Yeah. And eventually just got comfortable with it to where he was totally good. I don't even know if Kansas wins the league. If that doesn't happen, I think that maybe they split it, but who knows. But for Self to win the league this year and then win the conference tournament without Azubuike, and then, you know, win opening weekend basically without Azubuike, and then beat Clemson and Duke, make its third Final Four this year, I guess it is. It's super impressive.
And throwing the whole, like, Billy Preston saga, and even getting Silvio D'Souza, you know, halfway through and having to figure out how the hell to use him. That's why I think, okay, even if they don't win the title, I think everyone that did the whole Bill Self's not that good is at least silenced a little bit.
I mean, Self certainly deserves his criticisms for his past Elite Eight performances. He's had some rough goes there. You know, last year, just driving a Jordan Bell over and over again wasn't necessarily the soundest of strategies.
That wasn't great.
You know, I think he came out tonight and outcoached one of the best coaches that college basketball has ever seen in a game that, had he lost, I think would have, you know, hung on whatever ambiguous legacy exists.
So, looking forward now, what's your take on this matchup with Villanova?
Well, it's certainly a fairer fight from a size perspective, right? There's no Marvin Bagley at the four, although obviously I think Nova will play some possessions with Peschgal and Spellman both on the floor at the same time. I really, if I were guessing, that matchup comes down to who makes more shots, which is a really lame thing to say, but both of those offenses, I've kind of thought those two offenses over the course of the season were the two most explosive in the country in terms of their ability to just go on runs and put up points in bunches. And they obviously do that by knocking down threes. And so I think that perimeter battle will probably decide the game. If there's an individual matchup that will decide it, I'm sure that it's Devontae Graham versus Jalen Brunson. Although, you know, Malik Newman is kind of taking over some of those playmaking responsibilities for Devontae Graham. But Devontae has yet to have a great game in this tournament, and Kansas will probably need him to have one to beat Villanova.
Yeah. So who do they put Bridges on Newman, or do you put Bridges on Svi?
I think they'll probably put Bridges on Svi, and they'll let Phil Booth guard
Newman.
Yeah.
God, because you can get away, like, you can put Pascal on Garrett, or even, I guess, when Vic comes in, you adjust a little bit.
And the truth is, I mean, these two teams played in the Elite Eight, right, 2 years ago, and Villanova won a tight one. And that game, they actually played a lot of zone and just kind of rotated their defenses in and out. And tried to confuse Kansas that way. I don't know that zoning this particular Kansas team is a good idea. Zoning that older Kansas team when they played with two bigs was probably a better one. But it wouldn't surprise me to see Jay Wright roll out you know, a number of different defenses to just kind of put pressure on Kansas in different ways.
Yeah, because we saw him run three today, right? Like, he ran the 2-3, yeah. He ran the switching man-to-man, and then he even ran two possessions of, like, that amoeba zone, I call it, where it's not truly a zone, but it's not truly man-to-man. I don't know. I love it, but it's really the only time they've ran it this year. I know he's run it in years past, but I'm curious to see, are you worried, or can Kansas fans worry about Azubuike having to guard Spellman away from the hoop? Because you can't leave
him. That's interesting. Like, I think that is a big problem. Spellman is probably a little more comfortable off the dribble than Wendell Carter is. But I thought one of the things that was really interesting tonight is Wendell Carter is a 40% plus three-point shooter this year, admittedly on a smaller number of attempts than Omari Spellman. But, like, Kansas wasn't even guarding him at the three-point line and was willing to let him take those shots. So it wouldn't surprise me if Kansas just kind of lets Omari Spellman take a couple of shots and make them before they get out there and defend on the perimeter. Because I think you're right that if Azubuike has to get out there and try to match Spellman with foot speed, he's probably in a losing battle that will, you know, cause him to not play very many minutes due to foul trouble.
What would, you know, what is there anything else you're looking at in this? Is it simply just come down to, can Graham outplay Brunson? Is that really it? Or is it Newman?
Well, that's what's interesting. It's like, I think over the course of this season, you probably would have said Devontae Graham was Kansas's most important player. And then since the start of the Big 12 tournament, Newman's kind of the person who's taken over that mantle. And even when they were running late game offense today, right, they were handing the ball over to Newman and letting him create his own shot. So I do think that that's an interesting question. But like I said, I think that given that Kansas hasn't had a good Devontae Graham game yet this NCAA tournament, it's probably time that he have that. Because Villanova's offense is so explosive that even if Newman shoots it well, even if Vic shoots it well, and Svi shoots it well, there's still a good chance that Kansas is going to need Devontae Graham to shoot it well and kind of put some points on the board. So I think he's really important in this particular matchup. And defending Brunson on the other end, too, is going to be a challenge given Brunson's kind of post-up game and all of that.
How ridiculous is this improved Malik Newman? Right? Because coming out of high school, he was a top 10 recruit, Mississippi State. Struggled, came off the bench. I mean, he looked like a freshman, looked like he was pressing a little bit. Part of that happens when you're playing, you know, in your hometown. It's supposed to be, I mean, let's be honest, he was supposed to be the savior of Mississippi State basketball.
Yeah.
And he wasn't, and took the year off transferring, and now he's, I mean, shit, he looks like a first-round pick. He looks like one of the 10 best players in college basketball. His run reminds me of Trayvon Blewett last year to the Elite Eight.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Blewett was the best player in the NCAA tournament last year to the Elite Eight. That's kind of like, I think Newman might be the best player in this tournament up to, you know, through today.
It's definitely possible. He's been really consistent. What's weird is I wrote about him on Friday night and put together a graph of his kind of individual offensive rating on a five-game basis, on a five-game average basis. And there's this, like, this huge dip at the end of November and December leading into conference play where he's, like, around a 90, which is basically awful. And then you start to get into March, and like there was a five-game stretch where he was topping 135, and I think right now he's up over 120, which is still excellent. And, you know, I don't know where it came from. I don't know if it was a confidence thing. I don't know if he started to see some shots fall, but he's gotten back to all of the things that made him great in high school, which is kind of pull-up jumper. He's got that smooth little step back through the legs that he does, and now he's getting to the basket at a rate that was not something I ever expected.
He's shooting roughly 340% when he's driving.
It's insane.
Like, he hasn't missed.
Yeah.
And he's defending.
He's been on fire. Yeah, I mean, tonight, right, Grayson gets the ball late in the game, and it's Malik Newman who's guarding him. I think that's, you know,
and it was
one of the things that's been consistent for him through the year is he has been a solid perimeter defender. He's willing and engaged.
That defense against Grayson at the end of regulation, I mean, that was perfect defense.
Yeah.
He sat on his offhand, didn't let him get the crossover, kind of forced him into – I mean, Grayson had a decent look, but he forced him into a weird shot, right? Like, it was a little, like, one-footer falling away. I mean, to me, everyone's going to talk about how the ball sat on the rim, and it would have been a hell of a shot. But to me,
insane
it was Newman's
shot.
Defense.
Yeah, it was great defense. I think he's honestly probably been Kansas's best perimeter defender this season, if you don't count, like, Marcus Garrett coming off the bench and playing that role. So, you know, now that he's turned into kind of the best two-way player on the team over this stretch, it's baffling because there was nothing really there other than you know, old hope of hoping that he turned into high school Malik Newman that suggested this was coming.
All right, so Kansas wins the national championship if what happens?
Probably if Devontae Graham gets playing back to form. I mean, I think that towards the end of the season, there was a case to be made that Devontae Graham should have been the national player of the year. I don't think it was necessarily a strong one, but he should have been in the conversation. And over the Big 12 tournament and the NCAA tournament, he hasn't played to that level. And I think that if he does play for that level, Kansas is going to be really difficult to stop.
Here's another question for you, because you do a lot of NBA draft stuff. Outside of Mikal Bridges, who's the best NBA prospect in this Final Four?
It is probably Jalen Brunson or Devontae Graham. On my board, it's certainly Jalen Brunson or Devontae Graham. Just as kind of those backup steady NBA point guard options. Obviously, you have Mo Wagner for Michigan. Svi Mykhailiuk is a borderline draftable prospect for Kansas. You know, Gerald Vick's probably somewhere in that grouping. Malik Newman is certainly playing his way into that grouping. But it's probably Jalen Brunson or Devontae Graham.
Yeah, because I was thinking about that just recently, about how this Final Four, it's a lot of big-time colleges and college names, but it's not like the couple years past where you had surefire top 20 picks. Like, there's one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm trying to think back to last year. I feel like we were in a somewhat similar situation where we had Zach Collins for Gonzaga, who was a likely lottery pick.
Justin
North Carolina.
Jackson.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. North Carolina had Justin Jackson and Tony Bradley, who were both first-rounders. Yeah. So it was probably a little bit better, but there wasn't anything like – you didn't have the top-tier elite guys at the top of the lottery that I think everybody kind of hopes will show up in March.
Yeah, because you had South Carolina with, obviously, no one was, you know, Thornwell and Dozier were looked at second-rounders. But then you had, what, North Carolina played. I guess Oregon, you had Jordan Bell.
Yeah, Oregon.
And
yeah.
Dylan Brooks. You had three guys that were borderline first-rounders.
Yeah, you had some guys. I mean, obviously this year, right, it's going to be weird because you have Loyola in the mix and they just don't really have NBA guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat similar to South Carolina.
Sure. Yeah, that's true.
Sorry. So, all right, where can everyone follow you at and where can everyone read your work?
Everybody can follow me on Twitter at CStoneHoops. You can read my work at Sporting News, Fansided, and Rush the Court.
Perfect. All right, Chris, appreciate it. Have a good time down there at the Zion Williamson dunk contest.
That's really all I'm looking forward to.
All right, I'll talk
to
you later.
Thanks for having me on, man.
See ya.
Later.
All right, and now I welcome on Scott Phillips from NBC Sports and NBC Sports Chicago. Scott, what's going on, man?
Not too much. Obviously, a crazy weekend of hoops, a great overtime finish that we just saw in that Duke-Kansas game, and really looking forward to this Final Four here next weekend.
Yeah, I feel like that Duke-Kansas game kind of was the perfect – I don't know if appetizer is the right word, but kind of like the bookend of the Elite Eight to get us to, like, hold us over for the week, because this week always sucks. No games during the week. It's just a long delay, and I feel like getting the overtime kind of helped a little bit.
Yeah, getting that extra 5 minutes of hoops between two blue blood programs really never hurts. It's never a bad thing, and obviously a little bit underwhelming at the end in terms of the execution of some things and the way that Kansas kind of ran away with things, but you can't ask for much better than two teams playing in front of a great crowd in Omaha and playing to that level going into the overtime.
Agreed. But as I mentioned, you're NBC Sports Chicago, which means you're on for a specific reason here, and it's, I think, a reason nobody would have guessed. And that
is
the Loyola Chicago Ramblers. And my question is very open-ended, and it's just, how the hell are they there?
I have no idea myself. if I'm being honest, I thought this team had a chance to compete in the Valley this year. I thought that especially after the Florida win on the road earlier this year that they could have made the NCAA tournament. But to see them now in the Final Four is just really startling. I mean, I even had this team making the Sweet 16 because I thought the matchups lined up properly for them. But to now win the South region and to kind of be the darling of the NCAA tournament, completely shocking to everybody who's covered this team this season.
Yeah, because what were the expectations? Like, you mentioned that you thought they could compete. What were the general expectations? Because Loyola is not, I mean, it's a mid-major, but it's not necessarily a small school, right? Like, there's, what, 13,000 in the enrollment or so?
Yeah, it's a sizable school, and it is a proud basketball tradition. When you win a national championship, I don't care if it's 1963 or 2003, that means something to a portion of the fan base. And this has been a program that's been dormant for quite some time, but even when I went to games as a kid, there was kind of this legacy and this history behind what they had done in the past with the 63 run and the 1985 Sweet 16 run, where you had this sense that there was another run potentially coming within the next few years. But I don't think anybody really saw this run this soon. I mean, this team was 16-7 last season, kind of bottomed out and finished 7 of their last 9 losing in the Valley, didn't really look that promising going into this year. And they added a couple promising local freshmen, guys like Lucas Williamson and Cam Crutwig, who have been key parts of their rotation. And they've just really blossomed and taken off. This was a group that had high expectations entering each season, but let's be honest, what college basketball coach that you talk to doesn't have high expectations?
Right.
What college basketball coach says, oh, you know, we're going to bottom out, we're not going to be great this year. This was a team that thought they were going to succeed, and they lived up to the hype from day one.
What makes – you mentioned some of the freshmen in the rotation, but what makes this team good? Is it the defense? Is it the their ability that they – you know, they are patient on offense. You know, I'm not going to call them – you know, they're not going to outscore people like Nova does, but they're efficient and they execute very well on the offensive side of the ball. What makes this group special? Is there something that you can kind of pinpoint and go, all right, well, at least this is kind of what – I can understand why they're winning games with this specific thing.
This team is insanely unselfish, and that word is thrown around a lot in sports in terms of being a balanced team and having multiple pieces that can win your game. But when you look at this Loyola team from top to bottom and the rotation of 7 to 8 guys that they play, they really don't have a go-to guy on the offensive end, and they don't have a key guy that gets stops for you on the defensive end. This is really a team that, you know, relies on different pieces game in and game out to get things done. They utilize mismatches. They figure out ways to win. And really what's been most impressive about them is they've had certain guys like Ben Richardson, a senior who's been around, who've taken a back seat in scoring to other guys like Crutwig who have come in as freshmen. And you don't see that a lot in programs with four-year guys. And it's just been really impressive to see the selflessness that's been around this program from day one this season.
I know he'll never admit it, but is there something that you think Porter Moser's thinking about how special this run is, especially since he was in the Missouri Valley at Illinois State, a little over 13 years ago or so he was there, of succeeding, you know, with a school in the same state, in the same conference? Is there something that you think maybe he has a little, again, it's a cliche thing, but a chip on the shoulder?
Oh, absolutely he does, because, again, when he had the Illinois State job, it was at a time in the early 2000s, I should say mid-2000s, where I was of college age. I had a lot of friends who were going to Illinois State, and I remember them repeatedly saying the phrase, Porter is the Pits. He couldn't win games. He couldn't get them out of the doldrums. They just weren't a program that was figuring things out. It never finished higher than 6th in the Missouri Valley in his 4 years they were there. And when he got to Loyola, 4 of his first 5 seasons were losing seasons. He was 1-17 in the Horizon League the first year he was there. So really not a lot of people expected Porter Moser to have the kind of capabilities to turn around a team, not only to be a winning program, but to make a Final Four run like this.
You know, Clayton Custer is a guy that I think a lot of people are looking at because he, you know, Missouri Valley Player of the Year, point guard. You know, he's great with interviews. Always seems to have kind of a memorable line here or there. He is a transfer from Iowa State, so he does have high major talent, which I think pays off, especially at this stage of the NCAA tournament. But what is it about Custer, transferring in? Everyone knows the story. If not, he is high school teammates with Ben Richardson in Overland Park, Kansas, where they won a state title. Is there something with the addition to Custer that's given this team something a little different than maybe that it hasn't had, or letting them do something different offensively that you've seen?
He's just got this moxie and this swagger that not a lot of other guys on the roster maybe had before. Many of these guys on the Loyola roster, guys like Dante Ingram, who are seniors, came from programs like Simeon where they were part of a balanced operation. They didn't really have the, you know, the go-to capabilities where they could take over games and make plays. And again, that's not to say Clayton Custer is the guy who usually makes plays to win games for Loyola, but the ball is generally in his hands. He's the guy finding guys on, you know, passes, making plays off the dribble, finding guys. And yeah, I think that adding a guy like him where he had the reputation that he had coming in, where he's a former top 150 recruit, he played in the Big 12, and then he showed up with that confidence to make everyone around him better. I think that really said a lot about where this program was capable of heading these next few years.
You mentioned Simeon, and that's something I want to get into because I think Chicago is one of the more unique basketball cities in the sense of they really – you know, if you're a Chicago team or a Chicago guy, the whole city immediately eats you up. Like, that's you're theirs. What's the city like with this run in Loyola? Are they just completely backing them, like I kind of expect them to be?
Yeah, everyone's backing them. It's a pro sports town, so let's be honest. There's a lot of people who are still slow to get involved, who maybe haven't watched this team play during the year, or maybe didn't even jump on the bandwagon until the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight. But I had to see it for myself during the Sweet 16. I took the night off. I didn't have work. I had to go to a bar and see what the atmosphere was like. And I was shocked to find that there were bars all over the area with game sound, with people rooting for Loyola, cheering them on. And it's been a fun story to follow in Chicago so far. There hasn't been a lot of winning teams lately. The Bulls and the Blackhawks are both going to miss the playoffs for the first time in a decade. And really not a lot to look forward to except for spring training right now in Chicago. It's been a fun story to follow Loyola.
Yeah, especially because just Illinois college basketball has been down too, right? Like University of
down?
Illinois has
down. It's been dreadful.
I was trying to be nice. I was trying to be nice. It sucked. I mean, that's the only polite way to put it. It sucks because Illinois has been bad. DePaul's been bad. You know, even like Illinois State, they missed out on the tournament last year, but you know, I don't think they would make a run like this. It's crazy that it's Loyola. To me, it just still boggles my mind that here we are heading to the Final Four, and it's still Loyola kind of carrying the torch for Illinois basketball.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because Illinois has such a proud tradition when it comes to basketball. I mean, we're the state that coined the phrase March Madness. We used it in our IHSA basketball tournament. It was ours that we still share with the NCAA, and obviously you look at the programs that have won titles the last few years. Anthony Davis at Kentucky, Ryan Boatwright and Wayne Blackshear, all these teams are, you know, all these teams have Chicago guys on the roster when they win championships. And everyone around Illinois is kind of throwing their hands up saying, well, why can't we get some of these local guys to stay home and help us win? Well, now you have a Loyola team that's not only taking local guys, but they've recruited from everywhere. They have up transfers, they have down transfers, JUCO guys, international guys, and they're in a position now where they're not only in the Final Four, but they have a legitimate chance against this Michigan team now.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to ask you about. How does this game match up? Because I think, you know, it's going to be slow, right? Like, it's going to be slow.
Yeah.
Kind of, I don't know if ugly is the right word, but it's going to be not super enjoyable to watch for the casual fan that I think is going to tune into the game. That's not to say it's not going to be entertaining. I just don't think it's going to be super fun to watch for the person that's typically watching an NBA game or a football fan tuning in, because both these teams play such a slow pace.
Yeah, definitely. They're both in the 300s in adjusted tempo on KenPom. They're both going to want to ideally play this game in the 50s or 60s, and that's definitely a big advantage for Loyola. They've been really, really slow these last couple of months. That win over Kansas State was the first time they had scored over 70 points in over a month. This is a team that's dictated tempo. Miami and Tennessee were great matchups for them because both those teams were okay going slower with them. Thought Nevada was actually the worst matchup that Loyola had this tournament because they would want to get up and down the floor, and they had the weapons to kind of overpower them if they came to be. But after that hot start, Loyola really settled things down, slowed down to their tempo, and you know, dictated the rest of the game there. So I think that Michigan, again, a slowdown team, is an ideal matchup for where Loyola wants to play. But I think the key for Loyola is stopping the bigs in Michigan, guys like Wagner and Duncan Robinson, who can get out and space the floor, because they've played a lot of talented bigs in this tournament, good athletes, guys like DeJuan Hewell and Grant Williams, but they've never really faced a floor-spacing big like a Wagner or a Duncan Robinson, who's an impact on the defensive end, who can still make an issue on the offensive end spacing the floor.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask next. Is there one individual matchup within the game that you think Loyola has to win in order to have a chance to win?
Yeah, I think that they have to have Wagner shoot the ball poorly again from three. I think he was 0-for-7 in that win over Florida State. He wasn't particularly effective from the perimeter. And you look at Michigan this NCAA tournament, they haven't really shot the ball or been that great offensively.
No, they've played three bad offensive games.
Yeah, definitely. Outside of really that first 30 minutes against Texas A&M, this team hasn't played well offensively. And, you know, you go to the dome setting now in San Antonio and the pressure of things in the Final Four. And if you're Loyola, you're really hoping that Michigan, again, is off to a slow start on offense so that you're able to stay with a team that could really start to hit shots and run away from you.
Now, one of the interesting inside-the-matchup type deals is what Luke Jelich, is that how you pronounce his name, the assistant coach for Michigan that spent time at, where was he, Illinois State?
Yeah, Luke Yaklich.
Yeah. Do you think that's an advantage for either of the teams because, A, he knows the offensive schemes of Porter Moser, or on the flip side, Loyola knows kind of how he likes the defensive play because he's, for all intents and purposes, the defensive coordinator for Michigan. Do you see something there, or is that just, am I just trying to stay too woke almost on that?
You might be a little too woke for that. You know, Luke Yaklich wasn't with Illinois State for that many years. You know, a few, but generally speaking, I think that everything that is in this game is going to be known going into it. I don't think there's going to be any special advantages based on former Valley ties. I think that Porter Moser is going to be quite familiar with what John Beilein is running and vice versa. And, you know, Yaklich might have some insight onto certain guys and their tendencies on the Loyola roster, but I think generally speaking, it's not going to be too big of an impact.
Now, going back to the game, Charles Matthews obviously has ties to Illinois, being from St. Rita in Chicago. Is he – I always expect him to be a mismatch because he's kind of made to be that small ball four, even though don't call him a small ball four. Is he the mismatch for Michigan, or do you think it's someone like Wagner or even someone like Abdur Rahman?
I think it's definitely Wagner and Robinson because Loyola wants to play small. They'll go with the lineup with Trey Jackson at the five or Dante Ingram at the four, where everyone on the floor is 6'5 and 6'6. So, if, you know, if Michigan goes small and counters and runs a guy like Charles Matthews at the four or the five, they're going to be prepared for that. But by extension, that also is an advantage for Michigan because I don't think a lot of the teams that Loyola is prepared to this point were prepared to go small with them. Kansas State went small with them for a time, worked out okay in the first half. But I think Michigan's more equipped to go small ball with Loyola than some of these matchups they've faced so far.
Okay, so I'm ending it with everybody asking this. What does – Loyola wins the national championship if what happens?
They need to hit perimeter shots. That's one of the huge keys. They have to dictate tempo. I've gone over that before. They play comfortably in the 50s or 60s, but this is a big team that needs to hit perimeter shots as well. They shoot 40% from three. They expect four or five guys to knock down three-pointers each game, and if they're not hitting those outside shots, if their offense isn't capable of keeping up with these elite-level teams that we're going to see now in the Final Four, then Loyola might get blown out pretty quickly here.
Yeah, that's a good point. Are you worried at all that everyone else has that surefire pro, whether it's, you can list them off for Villanova. Kansas has a couple of those guys. Michigan has Wagner. And, you know, I think one of the other guys will eventually be a pro. Does it worry Loyola fans that they don't have a pro this late in the tournament where I think that's worth something?
I don't think it really worries Loyola fans, but it's certainly something to keep an eye on because, you know, when you beat teams like Florida and Miami and Tennessee and Nevada that have a lot of pros themselves, you're not really concerned with facing a team like Michigan at this point in the season. But, you know, if Michigan does hit 10 first-half three-pointers like they did against Texas A&M, let's be honest, Loyola does not have the firepower to keep up with a group like that. And that's something you have to be concerned about with a team like Michigan or Villanova or Kansas on the other side of the bracket. Loyola really can't score in the 70s or the 80s that easily unless they're really hitting outside shots. And these other teams probably can if given the right circumstances. And you have to watch for Loyola to maybe get outrun and outgunned a little bit in terms of the 70s and 80s there.
If Loyola is to actually win this thing, it would be the most improbable story since what? I mean, I like keep trying to figure out like how far back do we have to go for this to be like, holy hell, I can understand this champion, I can understand this champion. This one makes zero sense. How far back do you think we even have to go for that?
I mean, it's funny you ask that because we kind of went over the same circumstance when UMBC beat Virginia in the first round. It was like, where does this stack up in terms of perspective and, you know, the historical relevance of things. But with this Loyola team, it'd actually be a championship. So, man, I have no idea. Maybe the miracle on ice, and that was, you know, a semifinal game, but they obviously went on to win the gold. But where do you really compare an 11 seed coming out of nowhere to trounce all these national teams to win a national title? It would kind of be unfathomable.
Yeah, and especially the way that they did it, too, because, all right, yeah, the South region broke weird, but you beat Michigan – and then either a one seed in the finals, either it's Kansas or Villanova. It's not like you're beating, you know, 10 seed, 9 seed, 8 seed the entire time.
Yeah, that's a huge point. I mean, obviously the South Regional has been chaotic, but Loyola has still beaten an ACC powerhouse in Miami. They've still beaten an SEC co-champion in Tennessee. They beat a really good perennial top 25 team in Nevada, and they knocked off Kansas State, who was fourth in the Big 12 this year. It's not like they had the bracket break where they were the underdog in any of these games. They still had to overcome and beat quality competition. So they're not going to be fazed by this game. Again, it'll be fascinating to see how kind of the magnitude of everything hits everybody, because those first 10 minutes of any Final Four game are shaky. And if Loyola can withstand that and stay close and Michigan isn't hitting a barrage of three-pointers, I think there's a serious chance they stay in the game with the Wolverines.
I agree. All right, Scott, where can everyone follow your stuff and your work at?
You can find me on Twitter at Phillip Soups, P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S Hoops, all one word. And most of my work will be found on NBC Sports College Basketball Talk and NBC Sports Chicago this March.
All right, man. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
Thanks.
All right. Now I welcome on former Michigan player Zach Novak. Zach, what's going on, man?
Not much, man. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, it's a good time to be a Wolverine. It seems like Michigan's winning at every sport, sans the sport that they're supposed to be a football school of.
Yeah, I think, a hockey team going to the Frozen Four today, basketball team going to the Final Four, I think women's gymnastics even just won a Big Ten title all in this weekend. So we've got it going right now. Hopefully football can follow suit in the fall.
So this feels like it's been, I don't want to say a long time coming, because it hasn't been that long since Michigan's been in a Final Four, but it seems like it was due at some point, because what Michigan's made – an Elite Eight when they lost to Kentucky, a Sweet 16 last year, you get back to Elite Eight this year. And Beilein's just too damn good of a coach to not get back to the Final Four. And you were out at the games. Is there something that you've seen with this team lately where they just simply can't lose winning the Big Ten tournament, getting the home win over Ohio State, and now obviously getting to the Final Four?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is, you know, if I look at some of our past teams, if you have a rough shooting night, we typically didn't have, you know, the lockdown defense to get us through multiple of those games. So you might be able to get through one or two, but because of the way this team defends, you know, they've really played one good game in the tournament offensively, and the other three they've had to gut it out on the defensive end. And that's really, I think, what's the difference for them right now. They're guarding, and I think it's the mentality they have to guard than we had in the past.
That's what I was going to ask. What makes this team so good defensively? Because they're, I think, fourth now or third on KenPom's adjusted defensive ranking.
Yeah.
You know, they're playing games in the 60s, and it's not just because of the slower tempo, but because of, like you said, their ability to guard. But is there something specific about roster makeup or scheme-wise that makes this team just that good defensively?
I think there's been two big things. I think one is you've got two guys on the floor who are elite-level defenders, in my opinion. So you've got Xavier and then Charles Matthews, who are just in people. I think the rest of the team feeds off of that. But I think the bigger thing is just how they've changed the approach to coaching defense. So we have Beilein's not really like coaching the defense as much as he used to. And it's kind of like offense, defensive coordinator in football, where we have Yaklich who's running the defensive side of the ball. And so, you know, what that allows Beilein to focus on offense and dialing up different plays and sets, which is what you want him doing.
There's very few others I'd want.
Yeah, exactly, right? And then it allows us to have somebody who's, you know, continually focusing on the defensive end. Because I think, you know, as much as, you know, Beilein is an offensive-minded guy. So, like, the example he'll give is, like, look, in the past where we missed a shot and, you know, maybe we didn't get a good look, I'm thinking about what play we should run next, when really – I missed that somebody didn't get back on defense in transition. And so dividing that up, I think, has allowed them to have more of a focus than we had in the past. And it's working.
It seems, and going to Beilein, it seems like he's finally starting to get his due on a national level, of more people talking about him. you know, as a top 10, top 15 coach in America, whatever it is. And it felt like he was always a little bit under the radar, a little bit undervalued. He'll never admit it publicly because that's just not his personality. But do you think it's kind of rewarding for him to not necessarily, but to see the team results and to be, as a former player of his, is it just kind of fulfilling to see him start being talked about this way?
Yeah, as a former guy, I was in his first recruiting class at Michigan. It's pretty cool for me because, when I was coming in, he was telling us about the vision and how, where we were going to get to with the program. And so it's really coming to fruition right now. We hadn't been to the tournament in 11 years when he took the job. Obviously, everybody knows about what had happened in the 90s and the fallout of that. And he's basically just backed up every single thing he said he was going to do, plus more probably. I think that people are finally starting. Everyone always knew he was a great offensive X's and O guy. But the crazy thing to me is that he's adapted to the point where, they're not running. It's not his two-guard offense anymore that's, winning us games at this point. But he's coaching, he's taking guys, he's getting the most out of the talent. We just talked about what he's doing on the defensive side of the ball. He's adapting to the way the game's changing, and he's doing it in a way that's a higher level than 99% of the other coaches out there. It is good to see.
You mentioned the two-guard offense, and that's what he's obviously known for. What makes that two-guard motion offense so difficult to, A, defend, and B, is it tough to learn going through the system as a whether you're a freshman coming in or a transfer like Matthews?
So I think what makes it unique is that it is a lot. If you run it like pure, if you look at how his teams at West Virginia ran it, because in my opinion, those later teams that he had with Gandy and his son Pat, they ran it the best. And the reason it's so difficult is because you've always got shooters, 1 through 5. That's difficult to guard. And there's read-based actions on every play. So he's trusting guys to see what the defense is giving them. And within a play, there might be 10 different ways the play can end up, but he doesn't have to call each piece of that. So it's very difficult to guard, which also makes it really difficult to learn for some people. And so it's odd. I've seen guys who are studying to get their medical degree who come in, can't figure out how to run the offense. And there's guys who, are not the best in school or academically come in and pick it up right away. There's really no rhyme or reason for it. I don't think it's all that difficult to pick up. I didn't have any problems with it, but it's definitely more complex than the majority of offenses that are being run.
So going back to this year's team, I think one of the points that everyone kind of looks at of the turn of the season is getting Xavier Simpson back into the starting point guard spot, and his play, like you mentioned, defensively, he's turned into one of the best defensive point guards in the country. Is that it for you too, looking at that spot, or is there somewhere else along the season where you can point to and be like, all right, this is where I can kind of see this team developing into what it is now?
I think a couple of things have happened. The Xavier thing was big. John Teske emerged as a great backup for Mo, which is huge because Mo gets into foul trouble.
Yep.
And so having somebody who can come in and really defend, and also he's been running the floor and finishing in transition, he's been way more than expected.
And he's a different look too, right? Like he's your more traditional big.
Yeah, and he's huge. He's like 7'1".
He's
so
a monster.
He's a big body that you bring in. So that's huge. And then the other two that I look at is Charles Matthews. He started off really well, kind of went into a little bit of a slump during Big Ten, and now, obviously, as you saw last night, has come back and emerged on the offensive end, which is huge for us because he gives us something unique that we don't have anywhere else in the team, and a guy that can really slash. And then Mo himself, I would say is the last one. I don't think he had the start to the year that he would have liked to have, but he's firing on all cylinders now. And I think you saw that like starting to happen in like January, like mid January, he started to catch his rhythm. And so if we've got all these guys clicking, we're really tough to beat.
So now you head into the Final Four. Michigan heads in the Final Four against Loyola. Obviously not a team you expect to see in the Final Four, but here they are. What is it about this matchup that you're kind of looking to if you're a Michigan fan going, all right, here's what we kind of need to do in order to win this game?
Well, you know, they're an extremely well-coached team. They have experienced guys that, you know, obviously they've never played at this level, but neither have any of our guys played at this level. Coach has been there. So I think the biggest thing for us will be we have to make them, from what I haven't watched them a ton, but it seemed like when they were playing Kansas State didn't really run great offense. So they didn't make a move on D, and they let them get out in transition, and they can hit some threes if you allow them to. And they got hot in that game. Some of their other games, it seems like they've been playing around the 60s. So I'm not sure they're really trying to speed up the tempo too much. I'd imagine they try to slow the game down against us. That's what I would do if I were them. So I think the key is we got to get out to a good start, because it's tougher to slow the game down if you're playing from behind. I think we need to be disciplined. They're not going to beat themselves. I think they're pretty well coached, and we got to make shots. You know, we've now in three of the four games, we haven't been able to hit shots. We need the ball to go in the basket if you're going to cut down the nets next weekend.
I was going to say, how weird is it to be a Michigan fan and a Michigan former player to hear you struggle offensively for three games and you're in a Final Four? It just does it still just not sound right to you?
it totally does. It's wild, yeah. And it came out of nowhere too, because we had Billy Donlin last year, who came in as an assistant coach, and he was supposed to be like the defensive guy. And I actually thought our defense last year was much better than it had been. He leaves to go to Northwestern, and I'm like, oh man, well there goes the defense again. And then we bring in this coach who, I think I read 5 years ago, the guy was a high school basketball coach.
Yeah.
So we bring this guy in, and all of a sudden, you know, we're a KenPom 3 or 4, whatever we are now. It's just like, never in a million years would I have thought, oh yeah, we're gonna ride our defensive prowess all the way to San Antonio for the Final Four.
So I've been asking everyone else who's come on this question. Michigan wins the national championship if what happens? And you kind of alluded to it, but is it just simply making these buckets now?
So I think Nova is going to come out of the other side. They look unbelievable. And I think the key to that game is can Xavier shut down Brunson? He's shut down everybody. And so that I look at that matchup and I'm just like, if you shut him down, you're going to beat that team. Can he do it? And if he can, and we come out, and again, we do need to make shots. If you're going to beat that team, you know, the way I think about it is their average, you know, offensive night is like incredible. It's like shy of one of our best offensive nights, but we do have the ability more so than other teams to get hot and go match them in a shootout. It comes down to me, you need to bring some offense. You're not just going to, you know, score 50, 60 and beat them. But two, can we shut down Brunson? And I think he can. He's shut down everybody this year.
So you were out in L.A. How did the arena have a reaction when Florida State didn't foul down 4 with 10 seconds to go?
I think everyone was kind of shocked. Because normally, you know, you have that moment where you're starting to dribble out the clock and, you know, the crowd starts to get get going a little bit, it felt like there was almost like a pause where there was like 3 seconds where we're sitting there waiting, like, oh, of course they're going to foul. And with our free throw shooting, why wouldn't you? And they don't do it. So it was like waited for 3 seconds and realized, like, wow, these guys are going to let us just win the game and walk out of here. And then it, you know, it was normal. But it's odd. And I still don't understand the decision not to foul, but I'm not going to argue with it.
I had people like yelling at me, yeah. Like, well, it's Duncan Robinson with the ball. It's like, okay, so worst case scenario, you're still down 2 possessions. You hit a 3, and then you just try to deny Duncan Robinson the entry pass.
I mean, you're going to – it's for a trip to the Final Four. I'm fouling to the last second.
Right. It's not, and that's in no means why Florida State lost, but it sealed the loss.
Yeah, no, I mean, there was other things that happened in the game, but it's just like it was very odd.
Yeah.
Very odd not to foul. Right?
I was curious if the arena, because it was 99% Michigan fans – even
it was
had a
just
reaction.
Like a tape delay.
A delay. Yeah, that makes sense. It's just more jubilation, like, holy shit, we're going to the Final Four, and they didn't foul.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, man. I appreciate you hopping on. Where can everyone follow you at?
You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Novak, NOVAK3159. I do most of my stuff on there, so. I will be tweeting over the next weekend and week for sure, leading into the Final Four, and hopefully we'll be celebrating Michigan cutting down the nets here in a week.
All right, man. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
All right, buddy. Appreciate it. See you.